I had never looked like much. It looked less impressive now, all scorched. The stones split in the heat. Before they burned them all away, the grain sacks would have hidden the trapdoor. I found it with a little prodding. Reich huffed and puffed behind me all the time. "Open it up." I pointed to the ring set in the stone slab. Reich didn't need telling twice. He got down and heaved the slab up as if it weighed nothing. And there they were, barrel after barrel, all huddled up in the dusky dark. The old Burgermeister kept the festival beer under the grain tower. Every local knows that. A little stream runs down there to keep it all nice and cool-like. Looks like what, 20? 20 barrels of golden festival beer. I smiled. Reich didn't smile back. He stayed on his hands and knees, and let his eye wander up the blade of my sword. I imagined how it must tickle against his throat.
"See now, Jorg, brother Jorg, I didn't mean..."
he started. Even with my sword at his neck, he had a mean look to him. Makin clattered up and came to stand at my shoulder. I kept the blade at Reich's throat. "I may be little, little Reichy, but I ain't a bastard," I said, soft, in my killing voice. "Isn't that right, Father Gomst? If I was a bastard, you wouldn't have to risk life and limb to search the dead for me, now would you?"
"Prince Jorg, let Captain Bortha kill this savage."
Gomst must have found his composure somewhere.
"We'll ride on to the tall castle and your father."
"My father can damn well wait," I shouted. I bit back the rest, angry at being angry. Reich forgot about the sword for a moment.
"What the feck is all this prince shit? What the feck is all this Captain Bortha shit? And when do I get to drink the fecking beer?"
We had ourselves as full an audience then as we'd get. All the brothers about us in a circle. "Well," I said, "since you are so nice, Brother Reich, I'll tell you." Makin raised his brows at me, and he took a grip on his sword. I waved him down. "The Captain Bortha shit is Makin, being Captain Makin Bortha of the Ankrath Imperial Guard. The Prince shit is me being the beloved son and heir of King Olidan of the House of Ankrath. And we can drink the beer now, because today is my 14th birthday. And how else would you toast my health?" Every brotherhood has a pecking order. With brothers like mine, you don't want to be at the bottom of that order. You're liable to get pecked to death. Brother Job had just the right mix of whipped cur and rabies to stay alive there. Chapter 8. So we sat on the tumbled stones of the Burgermeister's house and drank beer. The brothers drank deep and called out my name. Some had it Brother Jorg, some had it Prince Jorg, but all of them saw me with new eyes. Reich watched me, beer foam in his stubbled beard, the line of my sword across his neck. I could see him weighing the odds. A slow ballet of possibilities working their way across his low forehead. I didn't wait for the word ransom to bubble to the surface. "He wants me dead, little Reichy," I said. "He sent Gomsti out to find proof I was dead, not to find me. He's got a new queen now." Reich gave a grin that had more scowl than grin in it, then belched mightily.
"You ran from a castle with golden women to ride with us? What idiot would do that?"
I sipped my beer. It tasted sour, but that seemed right somehow. "An idiot who knows he won't win the war with the king's guard at his side," I said.
"What war, Jorg?"
The Nuban sat close by, not drinking. He always spoke slow and serious.
"You want to beat the Count? Baron Kennick?"
"The war," I said. "All of it." Red Kent came over from the barrels, his helm brimming with ale.
"Never happen," he said.
He lifted the helm and half-drained it in four swallows.
So you're Prince of Ancrath, a Copper Crown Kingdom. Must be dozens with as good a claim on the High Throne. Each of them with their own army.
More like 50,
Wright growled. Closer to 100, I said. I've counted. 100 fragments of empire grinding away at each other in a never-ending cycle of little wars, feuds, skirmishes, kingdoms waxing, waning, waxing again. Lifetimes spent in conflict and nothing changing. Mine to change, to end, to win. I finished my beer and got up to find Makin. I didn't have to look far. I found him with the horses, checking his stallion, Firejump. What did you find? I asked him. Makin pursed his lips.
I found the pyre, about 200, all dead. They didn't light it, though, probably scared off.
He waved toward the west.
I came in on foot, up the marsh road, and over the ridge yonder. Had about 20 archers in the thicket by the stream, to pick off folks that tried to run.
How many men altogether? I asked.
Probably 100, foot soldiers most of them.
He yawned and ran a hand from forehead to chin.
2 days gone now. We're safe enough.
I felt invisible thorns scratching at me, sharp hooks in my skin. Come with me, I told him. Makin followed me back to the steps and fallen pillars at the Burgomeister's doors. The brothers had Michael staving in a second barrel.
What-o, Captain?
Burlow called out at Makin, his voice still hoarse from Reich's strangling. A laugh went up at that, and I let it run its course. I felt the thorns again, sharp and deep, sharpening me up for something. 200 bodies in a heap, all dead.
Cap'n Makin tells me we're going to have company, I said.
Makin's brows rose at that, but I ignored him.
20 swords, rough men, bandits of the lowest order.
Not the sort you'd like to meet, I told them.
Idling along in our direction, weighed down with loot.
Wright got to his feet all sudden-like, his flail rattling at his hip.
Loot?
Slugs, I tell you, growing rich off the destruction of others.
I showed them my smile.
Well, my brothers, we're going to have to show them the error of their ways.
I want them dead, every last one. And we'll do it without a scratch. I want trip pits in the main street. I want brothers hidden in the Grain Tower and the Blue Boar Tavern.
I want Kent, Roe, Lyre, and the Newman here, behind these walls, to shoot them down when they come between tower and tavern.
The Newman hefted his crossbow, a monstrous feat of engineering, worked in the old metal and embellished with the faces of strange gods. Kent tossed the dregs from his helm and set it on his head, ready with his longbow.
Now, they might come over the ridge instead, so Reich's going to take Michael and 6 others to hide in the tannery ruins. Anyone comes that way, let them past you, then gut them.
Makin will be our scout to give us warning. The good father here, and you 5 there, you're going to stand with me to tempt them in.
The brothers needed no telling. Well, Job did. But Reich hauled him out of the beer quick enough, and he wasn't gentle about it.
Look! Reich shouted the words in his face. Get digging trippets, shitbrains!
They knew how to set up an ambush, those lads. No mistake there. No one knew better how to fight in the ruins. Half the time they'd make the ruins themselves. Half the time they'd fight in somebody else's.
Burlow, Makin! I called them to me as the others set about their tasks.
I don't need you to scout, Makin, I said, keeping my voice low. I want you 2 to go to the thicket by the stream. I want you to hide yourselves. Hide so a bastard could sit on you and still not know you were there. You hide down there and wait. You'll know what to do.
Prince, Brother Jorg,
Makin said. He had a big frown on, and his eyes kept straying down the street to Old Gomsty praying before the burned-out church.
What's this all about?
You said you'd follow wherever I led, Makin, I answered. This is where it starts. When they write the legend, this will be the first page. Some old monk will go blind illuminating this page, Makin.
This is where it all starts. I didn't say how short the book might be, though. Makin did that bow of his. That's half a nod, and off he went. Fat Burlo hurrying behind. So, the brothers dug their traps, laid out their arrows, and hid themselves in what little of Norwood remained. I watched them, cursing their slowness, but holding my peace. And by, only Father Gompst, my five picked men, and I remained on show. All the rest, a touch over 24, lay lost in the ruins. Father Gompst came to my side, still praying. I wondered how hard he'd pray if he knew what was really coming. I had an ache in my head now, like a hook inserted behind both eyes, tugging at me. The same ache that started up when the sight of old Gompsty made me think of going home. A familiar pain, one I'd felt at many a turn on the road. Oft times I'd let that pain lead me, but I felt tired of being a fish on a line. I bit back. I saw the first scout on the marsh road an hour later. Others came soon enough, riding up to join him. I made sure they'd seen the seven of us standing on the Burgomeister's steps.
"Company,"
I said, and pointed the riders out.
"Shit, Don!"
Brother Elban spat on his boots. I'd chosen Elban because he didn't look like much, a grizzled old streak in his rusty chainmail. He had no hair and no teeth, but he had a bite on him.
"They's no brigands. Look at them ponies."
He lisped the words a bit, having no teeth and all. "You know, Elban, you might be right," I said, and I gave him a smile. "I'd say they look more like house troops."
"Lord have mercy,"
I heard old Gompsty murmur behind me. The scouts pulled back. Elban picked up his gear and started for the market field, where the horses stood grazing.
"You don't want to do that, old man," I said softly. He turned and I could see the fear in his eyes.
"You ain't gonna cut me down, is you, Jorth?"
He couldn't say Jorg without any teeth. I suppose it's a name you've got to put an edge on. "I won't cut you down," I said. I almost liked Elban. I wouldn't kill him without a good reason.
"Where are you going to run to, Elban?"
He pointed over the ridge.
"That's the only clear way. Get snarled up elsewise or worse, back in the marsh."
"You don't want to go over that ridge, Elban," I said. "Trust me."
And he did, though maybe he trusted me because he didn't trust me, if you get my meaning. We stood and waited. We sighted the main column on the marsh road first. Then moments later, the soldiers showed over the ridge. 24 of them, house troops, carrying spears and shields, and above them, the colours of Count Renner. The main column had maybe 60 soldiers, and following on behind in a ragged line, well over 100 prisoners, yoked neck to neck. Half a dozen carts brought up the rear. The covered ones would be loaded with provisions. The others held bodies, stacked like cordwood.
"House Renner doesn't leave the dead unburned. They don't take prisoners," I said.
"I don't understand,"
Father Gompst said. He'd gone past scared into stupid. I pointed to the trees.
"Fuel. We're on the edge of a swamp. There's no trees for miles in this peat bog. They want a good blaze. So they're bringing everyone back here to have a nice big bonfire."
I had an explanation for Renner's actions, but as to my own, like Father Gompst, I wasn't sure I understood either. Whatever strength I had on the road, it came to me through a willingness to sacrifice. It came on the day I set aside my vengeance on Count Renner as a thing without profit. And yet here I was, in the ruins of Norwood, with a thirst that couldn't be quenched by any amount of festival beer, waiting for that self-same count, waiting with too few men and with every instinct telling me to run, every instinct, except for that one, to hold or break, but never bend. I could see individual figures at the head of the column quite clearly now. 6 riders, chain-armoured, and a knight in heavy plate. The device on his shield came into view as he turned to signal his command. a black crow on a red field, a field of fire. Count Ossin Renar wouldn't lead 100 men into an Ankrath protectorate. So this would be one of his boys, Marklus or Jarko.
"The brothers won't fight this lot," Elben said.
He put a hand on my shoulder plate.
"We might find a path out through the trees if we get to the horses, Jorth."
Already 20 of the Renar men hastened toward the tree line, holding their longbows before them so they wouldn't snag.
"No,"
I let out a long sigh. "I'd best surrender." I held out my hand.
"White flag, if you please."
The house troops had deployed by the time I made my way down toward the main column. My flag should properly be described as grey, an unwholesome grey at that, torn from Father Gomst's hassock.
"Noble-born," I shouted. "Noble-born under flag of truce."
That surprised them. The house troops fanned out behind our horses. Let me cross the market field unhindered. They looked to be a sorry lot. The metal scales falling from their leathers, rust on their swords. Homebodies they were, too long on the road and not hardened to it.
"The lads want to be first on a fire,"
one of them said. A skinny bastard with a boil on each cheek. He got a laugh with that.
"Noble born," I called out. "Flag a truce."
I didn't expect to get this far with my sword. I caught the stink of the column and could hear the weeping. The prisoners turned blank eyes upon me. Two of Renner's riders came forward to intercept me.
"Where'd you steal the armor, boy?"
"Go fuck yourself," I said. I kept it pleasant.
"Who've you got leading this show, then?" "Marklos."
They exchanged a look at that. A wandering hedge knight probably wouldn't know one son of the house Renner from the next.
"It doesn't do to kill a noble prisoner without orders," I said.
"Best let the Count, Ling, decide." Both riders dismounted. Tall men, veterans by the look of them. They took my sword. The older one, dark-bearded with a white scar under both eyes, found my knife. The cut had taken the top of his nose, too.
"You're a bit of an ugly mess, aren't you?"
I asked. He found the knife in my boot as well. I had no plan. The pain in my head hadn't left any room for one. I'd ignored the wordless voice that had led me for so long. Ignored it for the joy of being stubborn. And here I was, unarmed, amongst too many foes, stupid and alone. I wondered if my brother William was watching me. I hoped my mother wasn't. I wondered if I was going to die. If they'd burn me, or leave me as a maimed thing for Father Gomps to cart back to the tall castle.
"Everyone has doubts," I said, as Scarface finished his search.
"Even Jizu had his moment,
and I ain't him."
The man looked at me as if I were mad. Maybe I was, but I'd found my peace. The pain left me, and I saw things clear once again. They led me to where Marklos sat on his horse, a monstrous stallion, 20 hands if it was one. He lifted his visor then and showed a pleasant face, a bit fat in the cheeks, quite jolly really. Looks, of course, can be deceiving.
"Who the hell are you?"
he asked. He had a nice bit of plate on, acid-etched, with a silver inlay and burnished so it shone even in the dreariest of light.
"I said, who the hell are you?"
He got some red in his cheeks then. Not so jolly.
"You'll sing on the fire, boy, so you may as well tell me now."
I leaned forward as if to hear him. The bodyguards reached for me. But I did the old shake and twist. Even with me in armor, they were too slow. I used Marklos's foot as a step, where it stuck out from the stirrup, and got up alongside him in no time at all. He had a nice stiletto in a sheath set handy in the saddle. So I had that out and stuck it in his eye. Then we were off, the pair of us galloping out across the market field. How to steal a horse is the first thing you learn on the road. We bounced along, with him howling and shaking behind me. A couple of the house troops tried to bar the way, but I rode them down. They weren't going to get up again either. That stallion was fierce and big. The archers might have taken a shot or three, but they couldn't make sense of it from that distance, and we were headed into town. I could hear the bodyguard thundering along behind. It sounded as if they'd knocked a few men down themselves. They came close, but we'd taken them by surprise, me and Marklos, and got a start on them. And as we reached the outskirts of Norwood, they drew up short. At the first building, I wheeled sharply, and Marklos obliged by falling off. He hit the ground face first. Another one that wouldn't be getting up again. It felt good. I won't lie about that. I imagined the Count getting the news as he broke his fast. I wondered how he'd like the taste of it. Would he finish his eggs?
"Men of Renar!" I shouted it hard enough to hurt my lungs. "This town stands under the Prince of Ancrath's protection. It will not be surrendered."
I turned the horse again and rode on. A few arrows clattered behind me. At the steps, I drew up and dismounted.
"You came back?"
Father Gomst looked confused.
"I did,"
I said. I turned to face Elben.
"No fighting or retreat now, eh, brother?"
"You're insane."
The words escaped in a whisper. For some reason, he didn't lisp when he whispered. The riders, Marklos's personal guard, led the charge. Now that they had 50 foot soldiers around them, they had found their courage. Up on the ridge, the 24 house troops took their cue and began to run with the slope. The archers started to emerge from the thicket for better aim.
"These bastards will burn you alive if they take you that way," I said to the 5 brothers I had with me.
Then I paused, and I looked them in the eye, each one.
"But they don't want to die. They won't want to go back to the Count either way."
"Would you take old Bonfire Renner, his dead son, back? And smooth it over with an, 'Oh, yes, but we killed scavengers. There was this boy, and an old man with no teeth.'"
"So mark me now. You fight these tame soldiers, and you show them hell. Show them enough of it, and the bastards will break and run."
I paused and caught Brother Rodat's eye, for he was a weasel and liked to run, sense or no sense.
"You stick with me, Brother Rodat."
I looked to the thicket, over the heads of the men surging up from the market field, and saw an archer fall among the trees. Then another. An armored figure emerged from the undergrowth. The archers in front of him still had their eyes on the advance. He took the head from the first one with a clean swing. "Thank you, Macon," I thought. Fat Burlo came out at a run then, barreling his armored bulk into the bowman. The troops from the ridge passed by Reich's position, and his lads set to gutting them from behind. Not the sort of odds little Reiki favoured, but the word loot always did have an uncanny effect on him.
Choom!
The Nuban's crossbow shot its load. He couldn't really miss with so many targets, but by rights, he shouldn't be able to pick his man with that thing. Even so, both bolts hit the lead rider in the chest and lifted him out of his saddle. Kent and the other two rose from behind the Burgermeister's walls. They did a double take when they saw what was coming. But choices were in short supply, and they had plenty of arrows. The Renner troops hit our trip pits at full tilt. I swear I heard the first ankle snap. After that, it was all yelling as man went over man. Kent and Lyre and Roe took the opportunity to send a dozen more arrows into the main mass of the attack. The Nuban loaded his monster again, and this time nearly took the head off a horse. The rider went over the top, and the beast fell onto him, brains spilling on the ground. Some of those soldier boys didn't like the roads so much anymore and took to finding a way through the ruins. Of course, they found more than a way. They found the brothers who were waiting there. The archers broke first. There isn't much a man in a padded tunic with a knife at his hip can do against a decent swordsman in plate armor. And even Burlo was more than decent. 3 of the riders reached us. We didn't stay on the street to meet them. We fell back into the skeleton of what used to be Decker's smithy. So they rode in, slowly, ash crunching under hoof. Elban leapt the first one from an alcove over the furnaces. Took that rider down sweet as sweet, he did, his sharp little knife hitting home over and over. If you recall, I said Elban had a bite to him. Two brothers pulled the second rider down, feinting in and out until they got an opening. He had no room to move his horse around. Should have got off. That left me and Scarface. He had a bit more to him, and had dismounted before he followed us. He came at me slow and easy, the tip of his sword waving before him. He wasn't in a hurry. There's no rush when the best part of 50 men are hard on your heels. "Flag a truce," I said, trying to goad him. He didn't speak. His lips pressed together in a tight line, and he stepped forward, real slow. That's when Brother Rodat stepped up behind him and stuck a sword through the back of his neck. "Should have taken your moment, Scarface," I said. I got back onto the street just in time to meet some huge red-faced bastard of a house trooper who'd run his way up the hill. He pretty much exploded as the Nuban's bolts hit him. Then they were on us. The Nuban picked up his mattock, and Red Kent grabbed his axe. Rodat came past me with his spear and found a man to pin with it. They came in two waves. There were the dozen or so who'd kept up with Marklos's bodyguard, and then behind them, another 20 coming at a slower pace. The rest lay strewn along the main street or dead in the ruins. I ran past Rodat and the man he'd skewered, past a couple of swordsmen who didn't want me bad enough, and I was through the first wave. I could see that skinny bastard with the boils on his cheeks, there in the second wave, the one who'd joked about me on the fire. Me charging the second wave, howling for Boyle Cheeks' blood. That's what broke them. And the men from the ridge? They never reached us. Little Reiki thought they might be carrying loot. I reckon more than half of the Count's men ran. But they weren't the Count's men anymore. They couldn't go back. Makin came up the hill, blood all over him. He looked like Red Kent the day we found him. Burlow came with him, but he stopped to loot the dead. And of course, that involves turning the injured into the dead. "Why?" Makin wanted to know. "I mean, superb victory, my prince. But why in the name of all the hells run such a risk?" I held my sword up. The brothers around me took a step back. But to his credit, Makin didn't flinch. "See this sword?" I said. "Not a drop of blood on it." I showed it around, then waved it at the ridge. "And out there, there's 50 men who'll never fight for the Count of Renner again. They work for me now. They're carrying a story about a prince who killed the Count's son. A prince who would not retreat, a prince who never retreats. A prince who didn't have to blood his sword to beat 100 men with 30. "Think about it, Makin. I made Rodat here fight like a madman because I told him if they think you're not going to give up, they'll break. Now I've got 50 enemies who are out there telling everyone who'll listen that Prince of Ancrath, he's not going to break. It's a simple sum. If they think we won't break, they give up." All true. It wasn't the reason, but it was all true.
Chapter 9. 4 years earlier. The baton struck my wrist with a loud crack. My other hand caught hold as it rose. I tried to twist it free, but Lundist held tight. Even so, I could see his surprise.
"I see you were paying attention after all, Prince Jog."
In truth, I'd been somewhere else, somewhere bloody, but my body has a habit of keeping watch for me at such times.
"Perhaps you can summarize my points thus far," he said.
"We are defined by our enemies. This holds true for men, and by extension, their countries," I said. I'd recognized the book Lundis brought to the lesson. That our enemies shape us was its central thesis.
"Good,"
Lundis pulled his baton free and pointed to the table map. Geleth, Renar, and the Ken Marshes. Ancrath is a product of her environs. These are the wolves at her door. The Renar Highlands are all I care about, I said. The rest can go hang. I rocked my chair onto the back two legs. When Father orders the gate against Count Renar, I'm going too. I'll kill him myself if they let me. Lundis shot me a look, a sharp one, to see if I meant it. There's something wrong about such blue eyes in an old man. But wrong or not, he could see to the heart with them. Boys of 10 are better occupied with Euclid and Plato. When we visit war, Sun Tzu will be our guide. Strategy and tactics, these are of the mind. These are the tools of prince and king. I did mean it. I had a hunger in me, an aching for the Count's death. The tight lines around Lundist's mouth told me that he knew how deep the hunger ran. I looked to the high window where sunlight fingered into the schoolroom and turned the dust to dancing motes of gold. I will kill him, I said. Then, with a sudden need to shock, maybe with a poker, like I killed that ape Inch. It galled me to have killed a man and have no memory of it. Not even a trace of whatever rage drove me to it. I wanted some new truth from Lundist. Explain me, to me. Whatever the words, that was my question. Youth to old age. But even tutors have their limits. I rocked forward, set my hands upon the map, and looked to Lundist once more. I saw the pity in him. A part of me wanted to take it, wanted to tell him how I'd struggled against those hooks, how I'd watched William die. A part of me longed to lay it all down. That weight I carried, the acid pain of memory, the corrosion of hate. Lundist leaned across the table. His hair fell around his face, long in the fashion of Orient, so white as to be almost silver. We are defined by our enemies, but also we can choose them. Make an enemy of hatred, Jorg. Do that, and you could be a great man, but more importantly, maybe a happy one. There's something brittle in me that will break before it bends, something sharp that puts an edge on all the soft words I once owned. I don't think the Count of Renar put it there that day they killed my mother. He just drew the razor from its sheath. Part of me longed for a surrender, to take the gift Lundist held before me. I cut away that portion of my soul. For good or ill, it died that day. When will the gate march? I left nothing in my voice to say I'd heard his words. The army of the gate won't march, Lundist said. His shoulders held a slump, tiredness or defeat. That hit me in the gut, a surprise shot passing my guard. I jumped up, toppling the chair. They will! How could they not? Lundis turned toward the door. His robes made a dry sound as he moved, like a sigh. Disbelief pinned me to the spot, my limbs strangers to me. I could feel the heat rising in my cheeks. How could they not? I shouted at his back, angry for feeling like a child. Ancrath is defined by her enemies, he said, walking still. The army of the gate must guard the homeland, and no other army would reach the Count in his halls. A queen has died! Mother's throat opened again and coloured my vision red. The hooks burned in my flesh once more. A prince of the realm slain! Broken like a toy. And there is a price to pay. Lundist paused, one hand against the door, leaning as if for support. The price of blood and iron! Rights to the Cathan River, 3,000 ducats and 5 Araby stallions. Lundist wouldn't look at me. What? River trade, gold, horses. Those blue eyes found me over his shoulder. An old hand took the door-ring. The words made sense one at a time, not together.
"The army,"
I started,
"will not move."
Lundist opened the door. The day streamed in bright, hot, laced with the distant laughter of squires at play.
"I'll go alone. That man will die screaming by my hand."
Cold fury crawled across my skin. I needed a sword, a good knife at least, a horse, a map. I snatched the one before me, old hide, musty, the borders tattooed in Indus ink. I needed an explanation.
How? How can their deaths be purchased?
"Your father forged his alliance with the Horse Coast kingdoms through marriage. The strength of that alliance threatened Count Renard. The Count struck early, before the links grew too strong, hoping to remove both the wife and the heirs."
Lundis stepped into the light, and his hair became golden, a halo in the breeze.
"Your father hasn't the strength to destroy Renard and keep the wolves from Ankrath's doors. Your grandfather on the Horse Coast will not accept that. So the alliance is dead. Renna is safe. Now Renna seeks a truce so he may turn his strength to other borders. Your father has sold him such a truce."
Inside I was falling, pitching, tumbling, falling into an endless void.
"Come, Prince."
Lundist held out a hand. "Let's walk in the sunshine. It's not a day for desk learning." I bunched the map in my fist, and somewhere in me I found a smile, sharp, bitter, but with a chill to it, that held me to my purpose. "Of course, dear tutor. Let us walk in the sun. It's not a day for wasting. Oh, no." And we went out into the day, and all the heat of it couldn't touch the ice in me. Knife work is a dirty business. Yet Brother Grumlo is always clean. Chapter 10. We had ourselves a prisoner. One of Marklos's riders proved less dead than expected. Bad news for him, all in all. Makin had Burlo and Reich bring the man to me on the Burgermeister's steps.
"Says his name is Renton. Sir Renton, if you please," Makin said.
I looked the fellow up and down. A nice black bruise wrapped itself halfway round his forehead, and an over-hasty embrace with Mother Earth had left his nose somewhat flatter than he might have liked. His moustache and beard could have been neatly trimmed, but caked in all that blood they looked a mess.
"Fell off your horse, did you, Renton?"
I asked.
"You stabbed Count Renard's son under a flag of truce,"
he said. He sounded a little comical on the stabbed and son. A broken nose will do that for you.
"I did," I said. "I can't think of anything I wouldn't have stabbed him under."
I held Renton's gaze. He had squinty little eyes. He wouldn't have been much to look at in court finery. On the steps covered in mud and blood, he looked like a rat's leavings.
"If I were you, I'd be more worried about my own fate than whether Marklos was stabbed in accordance with the right social niceties."
That, of course, was a lie. If I were in his place, I'd have been looking for an opportunity to stick a knife in me. But I knew enough to know that most men didn't share my priorities. As Makin said, something in me had got broken, but not so broken I didn't remember what it was.
"My family is rich. They'll ransom me,"
Renton said. He spoke quickly, nervous now, as if he'd just realized his situation. I yawned.
"No, they're not. If they were rich, you wouldn't be riding in chain armor as one of Marklos's guards."
I yawned again, stretching my mouth until my jaw cracked.
"Michael, get me a cup of that festival beer, will you?"
"Michael's dead,"
Reich said from behind Sir Renton.
"Never," I said. "Idiot Michael.
I thought God had blessed him with the same luck that looks after drunkards and madmen."
"Well, he's near enough dead,"
Reich said.
Got him a gut full of rusty iron from one of Renner's boys. We laid him out in the shade.
Touching, I said.
Now get my beer.
Wright grumbled and slapped Job into taking the errand. I turned back to Sorrenton. He didn't look happy, but he didn't look as sad as you might expect a man in such a bad place to look. His eyes kept sliding over to Father Gomst. Here's a man with faith in a higher source, I thought.
So, Sorrenton, I said, what brings young Marklos to Ancrath's protectorates? What does the Count think he's up to?
Some of the brothers had gathered around the steps for the show, but most were still looting the dead. A man's coin is nice and portable, but the brothers wouldn't stop there. I expected the head cart to be heaped with arms and armour when we left. Boots, too. There's 3 coppers in a well-made pair of boots. Renton coughed and wiped at his nose, spreading black gore across his face.
I don't know the Count's plans. I'm not privy to his private counsel.
He looked up at Father Gomst.
As God is my witness.
I leaned in close to him. He smelled sour, like cheese in the sun.
God is your witness, Renton. He's going to watch you die.
I let that sink in. I gave old Gomsty a smile.
You can look after this knight's soul, Father. The sins of the flesh, though, they're all mine.
Reich handed me my cup of beer, and I had a sip. The day you're tired of looting, little Reiki, is the day you're tired of life, I said. It got a chuckle from the brothers on the steps.
Why are you still here, when you could be cutting up the dead in search of a golden liver?
Come to see you put the hurt on Ratface, Reich said.
You're going to be disappointed then, I said. Sir Ratface is going to tell me everything I want to know, and I'm not even going to have to raise my voice. When I'm done, I'm going to hand him over to the new Burgomeister of Norwood. The peasants will probably burn him alive, and he'll count it the easy way out. I kept it conversational. I find it's the coldest threats that reach the deepest. Out in the marshes, I'd made a dead man run in terror, with nothing more than what I keep inside. It occurred to me that what scared the dead might worry the living a piece too. Sorrenton didn't sound too scared yet, though.
You stabbed the better man today, boy, and there's a better man before you. You're nothing more than shit on my shoe.
I'd hurt his pride. He was a knight, after all, and here was a beardless lad making mock. Besides, the best I'd offered was an easy burning. Nobody considers that the soft option. When I was 9, the Count of Renner tried to have me killed. I said, I kept my voice calm. It wasn't hard. I was calm. Anger carries less horror with it. Men understand anger. It promises resolution, maybe bloody resolution, but swift. The Count failed. But I watched my mother and my little brother killed.
All men die,
Renton said. He spat a dark and bloody mess onto the steps.
What makes you so special?
He had a good point. What made my loss, my pain, any more important than everyone else's?
That's a good question, I said. A damn good question.
It was. There weren't but a handful of the prisoners we'd taken from Marklos's train who hadn't seen a son or a husband, a mother or a lover killed, and killed in the past week. And this was my soft option, the mercies of these peasants compared to the attention of a young man whose hurt stood 4 years old.
Consider me a spokesman, I said. When it comes to stage acting, some men are more eloquent than others.
It's given to particular men to have a gift with a bow. I nodded to the Nuban.
Some men can knock the eye out of a bull at 1,000 paces. They don't aim any better for wanting it. They don't shoot straighter because they're justified. They just shoot straighter. Now me, I just avenge myself better than most. Consider it a gift.
Renton laughed at that and spat again. This time I saw part of a tooth in the mess.
You think you're worse than the fire, boy?
He asked.
I've seen men burn, a lot of men.
He had a point.
You've a lot of good points, Sorrenton, I said. I looked around at the ruins. Tumbled walls in the most, and blackened timber skeletons where roofs had kept a lid on folks' lives for year after year.
"It's going to take a lot of rebuilding," I said. "A lot of hammers and a lot of nails."
I sipped my beer. "A strange thing. Nails will hold a building together, but there's nothing better for taking a man apart." I held Sorrenton's rat-like eyes, dark and beady. "I don't enjoy torturing people, Sorrenton, but I'm good at it. Not world class, you understand. Cowards make the best torturers. Cowards understand fear, and they can use it. Heroes, on the other hand, they make terrible torturers. They don't see what motivates a normal man. They misunderstand everything. They can't think of anything worse than besmirching your honor. A coward, on the other hand, he'll tie you to a chair and light a slow fire under you. I'm not a hero or a coward, but I work with what I've got." Renton had the sense to pale at that. He reached out a muddy hand to Father Gomst. "Father, I've done nothing but serve my master." "Father Gomst, we'll pray for your soul," I said, "and forgive me the sins I incur in detaching it from your body." Makin pursed those thick lips of his. "Prince, you've spoken about how you'd break the cycle of revenge. You could start here. You could let Sorrenton go." Wright gave him a look as if he'd gone mad. Fat Burlow covered a chuckle. "I have spoken about that, Makin," I said. "I will break the cycle." I drew my sword and laid it across my knees. "You know how to break the cycle of hatred?" I asked.
"Love," said Gomst, all quiet-like.
"The way to break the cycle is to kill every single one of the bastards that fucked you over," I said. "Every last one of them. Kill them all. Kill their mothers, kill their brothers, kill their children, kill their dog." I ran my thumb along the blade of my sword and watched the blood bead crimson on the wound. People think I hate the Count, but in truth, I'm a great advocate of his methods. He has only two failings. Firstly, he goes far, but not far enough. Secondly, he isn't me. He taught me valuable lessons, though, and when we meet, I will thank him for it. With a quick death. Old Gomsty started at that.
"Count Renner did you wrong, Prince Jorg. Forgive him, but don't thank him. He'll burn in hell for what he did. His immortal soul will suffer for eternity."
I had to laugh out loud at that. "Churchman, hey? Love one minute, forgiveness the next, and then it's eternity on fire. Well, rest at ease, Sorrenton. I've no designs on your immortal soul. Whatever happens between us, it will all be over in a day or two. Three at most. I'm not the most patient of men. So it'll end when you tell me what I want to know. Or I get bored." I got up from my step and went to crouch by Sorrenton. I patted his head. They'd tied his hands behind him, and I had my chainmail gauntlets on, so if he had a mind to bite, it'd do him no good.
"I swore to Count Renner," he said.
He tried to pull away, and he craned his neck to look at old Gomsty.
"Tell him, Father, I swore before God, if I break my vow, I'll burn in hell."
Gomst came to lay his hand on Renton's shoulder.
"Prince Jorg, this knight has made a holy vow. There are few oaths more sacred than that of a knight to his liege lord. You should not ask him to break it. Nor should any threat against the flesh compel a man to betray a covenant and forever place his soul in the fires of the devil."
"Here's a test of faith for you, Sir Renton," I said. "I'll tell you my tale, and we'll see whether you want to tell me the Count's plans when I'm done." I settled down on the step beside him and swigged my beer. When I first took to the road, I was, 10 years of age. I'd a lot of anger in me then, and a need to know how the world worked. You see, I'd watched the Count's men kill my brother, William, and slit Mother open. So I knew that the way I'd thought things were supposed to work was wrong. And of course, I fell in with bad sorts, didn't I, Reiki? Wright gave that laugh of his,
"Ho, ho, ho."
I think he just made the sound when he thought we expected a laugh.
didn't have any joy in it. I tried my hand at torture then. I wondered if I was supposed to be evil. I thought maybe I'd had a message from God to take up the devil's work. I heard Gomst muttering at that one, prayers or condemnation. It was true, too. For the longest time, I looked for a message in it all, to work out what I was supposed to be doing. I laid my hand on Renton's shoulder. He sat there with my hand on his left shoulder, and Gomst's hand on his right. We could have been the devil and the angel from those old scrolls, whispering in his ears. "We caught Bishop Murillo down by Jedmire Hill," I said. "I'm sure you heard about the loss of his mission. Anyhow, the brothers let me have the bishop. I was something of a mascot to them back then." The Nuban stood and walked off down the hill. I let him go. The Nuban didn't have the stomach for this kind of thing. That made me feel, I don't know, dirty. I liked the Nuban, though I didn't let it show. Now, Bishop Murillo was full of harsh words and judgment. He had plenty to tell me about hellfire and damnation. We sat a while and discussed the business of souls. Then I hammered a nail into his skull, just here. I reached out and touched the spot on Renton's greasy head. He flinched back like he'd been stung. "The bishop changed his tune a bit after that," I said. "In fact, every time I knocked a new nail into him, he changed his tune. After a while, he was a very different man. Did you know you can break a man into his parts like that? One nail will bring back memories of childhood. Another will make him rage, or sob, or laugh. In the end, seems we're just toys. Easy to break, and hard to mend." I hear that the nuns at St. Alstice still have Bishop Murillo in their care. He's a very different person now. He clutches at their habits and slurs awful things at them, so they say. Where the soul of that proud and pious man we took from the papal caravan is, well, I can't tell you. With that, I magicked a nail into my fingers, a rusty spike 3 inches long. The man wet himself. There on the steps, Bolo gave an oath and kicked him hard. When Renton got his breath back, he told me everything he knew. It took almost an hour. Then, we gave him to the peasants, and they burned him. I watched the good folk of Norwood dance around their fire. I watched the flames lick above their heads. There's a pattern in fire, as if something's written there, and there's folk who say they can read it too. Not me, though. It would have been nice to find some answers in the flames. I had questions. It was a thirst for the Count's blood that had set me on the road. But somehow, I'd given it up. Somehow, I set it aside and told myself it was a sacrifice to strength. I sipped my beer. 4 years on the road, always going somewhere, always doing something. But now, with my feet pointed toward home, it felt like I'd been lost all that time. Lost or led. I tried to remember when I'd given up on the Count, and why. Nothing came to me, just the glimpse of my hand on a door, and the sensation of falling into space. "I'm going home," I said. The dull ache between my eyes became a rusty nail, driven deep. I finished my beer, but it did nothing for me. I had an older kind of thirst. Chapter 11. 4 years earlier. I followed Lundist out into the day. "Wait!" He held his baton to my chest. "It never pays to walk blind, especially not in your own castle, where familiarity hides so much. Even when we have the eyes to see." We stood for a moment on the steps, blinking away the sunlight, letting the heat soak in. Release from the gloom of the schoolroom held no great surprise. 4 days in seven, my studies kept me at Lundist's side, sometimes in the schoolroom, the observatory, or library. But as often as not, the hours would pass in a hunt for wonders. Whether it was the mechanics of the siege machinery held in the Arnheim Hall, or the mystery of the builder light that shone without flame in the salt cellar,
Every part of the tall castle held a lesson that Lundist could tease out.
"Listen," he said.
I knew this game. Lundist held that a man who can observe is a man apart. Such a man can see opportunities where others see only the obstacles on the surface of each situation. "I hear wood on wood, training swords, the squires at play," I said.
"Some might not call it play. Deeper. What else?"
"I hear birdsong, skylarks." There it was, a silver chain of sound, dropped from on high. So sweet and light, I'd missed it at first.
"Deeper."
I closed my eyes.
What else?
Green fought red on the back of my eyelids. The clack of swords, the grunts, panting, muted scuffle of shoe on stone, the song of skylarks.
What else?
Fluttering. On the edge of hearing. I was probably imagining it.
"Good," Lundis said. "What is it?"
"Not wings. It's deeper than that. Something in the wind," I said.
"There's no wind in the courtyard," Lundis said.
"Up high, then." I had it. "A flag."
"Which flag? Don't look. Just tell me."
Lundis pressed the baton harder. "Not the festival flag. Not the king's flag. That's flown from the north wall. Not the colours. We're not at war. No, not the colours." Any curiosity in me died at that reminder of Count Renner's purchase. I wondered, if they'd slain me also, would the price of a pardon have been higher? An extra horse.
"Well?" Lundis asked.
"The execution flag, black on scarlet," I said. It's always been that way with me. Answers come when I stop trying to think it through and just speak. The best plan I'll come up with is the one that happens when I act.
"Good."
I opened my eyes. The light no longer pained me. High above the courtyard, the execution flag streamed in a westerly breeze.
"Your father has ordered the dungeons cleared," Lundis said. "There will be quite a crowd come St. Crispin's Day."
I knew that to be understatement. Hangings, beheadings, impalement. Oh my. I wondered if Lundis would seek to shield me from the proceedings. The corner of my mouth twitched, hooked on the notion that he might imagine I'd not seen worse already. For the mass executions of the previous year, Mother had taken us to visit Lord Nosser at his estates in Elm. William and I had the fort of Elm almost to ourselves. Later I learned that most of Ancreth had converged on the tall castle to watch the sport.
"Terror and entertainment are weapons of statehood, Jorg."
Lundis kept his tone neutral, his face inscrutable, save for a tightness in the lips, suggesting that the words carried a bad taste.
"Execution combines both elements."
He gazed at the flag.
"Before I journeyed and fell slave to your mother's people, I dwelt in Ling. In the utter east, pain is an art form. Rulers make their reputations, and that of their land, on extravagances of torture. They compete at it."
We watched the squires spar. A tall knight gave instruction, sometimes with his fist. For several minutes I said nothing. I imagined Count Renner at the mercy of a Ling torture master. No, I wanted his blood and his death. I wanted him to die knowing why he died, knowing who held the sword. But his pain? Let him do his burning in hell. "Remind me not to go to Ling, tutor," I said. Lundis smiled and led off across the courtyard.
"It's not on your father's maps."
We passed close by the dueling square, and I recognized the knight by his armor, a dazzling set of field plate with silver inlaid into acid-etched scrollwork across the breastplate. "Sir Makin of Trent," I said. I turned to face him. Lundis walked on for a few paces before realizing I'd left his side. "Prince Onerous," Sir Makin offered me a curt bow. "Keep that guard up, Cheeves," a barked instruction to one of the older boys.
"Call me Jorg," I said. I hear my father has made you captain of the guard.
He found fault with my